Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor LaCane. We now have one of the most autocratic presidents in the history of the United States. Trump continues to push for more and more power. Most Americans believe that no matter how power-hungry our president is, ultimately we'll be okay because we're protected by the Constitution. But will the Constitution really protect us against such an aggressive autocrat? Can the system of checks and balances set up by the Founding Fathers stand up to this unprecedented grab for power? Here to help us understand more about the Constitution are Cynthia and Sanford Levinson, authors of a new book called Fault Lines in the Constitution, The Framers, Their Fights, and the Flaws That Affect Us Today. Cynthia Levinson writes award-winning books about social justice for young readers. Sanford Levinson is a constitutional scholar and law professor at the University of Texas for almost 40 years. Cynthia and Sanford Levinson, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you.
Delighted to be here. Thank you for having us.
I'm so excited you're here, and I'm so excited you wrote this wonderful book. I would say, other than the Constitution itself, it's the best book I've ever read about the Constitution.
Well, we appreciate that.
Yeah. Well, you did such a great job, and I know, Cynthia, you're the one kind of oriented towards the young readers, but you wrote the book in such a way that it's got all the sophistication of the legal scholar and the Constitution professor that you are, Sanford, combined with, Cynthia, your great skills at communication to young readers. So you've written a book about the Constitution that every American could read. So thank you for that.
Well, we hope every American does.
Yeah, and I hope so, too. I've actually been very concerned about kind of the lack of civic education out there and the conversation we've had around how to deal with this president who is so aggressively arrogating power to himself, but, you know, up to and including the president who does not seem to understand or care about the balance of powers that's in the Constitution. So I'm hoping in this conversation today for some of our readers we could either refresh what they learned in school or maybe tell them, teach them, show them what they never got in school, because so many schools now don't teach civics and history. So let's get started with that, and let's begin by saying, why did you decide to write this book, The Fault Lines in the Constitution?
We were actually asked to write it by one of my editors at Peachtree Publishers. She had given to her father a copy of one of Sandy's many previous books. He's very prolific, called Framed, the subtitle of which is America's
51 Constitutions and the Crisis of Governance,
which is in some ways this book, Fault Lines, but specifically for grown-ups. And she and her father liked the book so much that she realized, I think it really opened her eyes to the relationship between the development of the Constitution in 1787 and today, and these fault lines, that she asked us to write the book for younger readers. And as you've noted, many people have said it also is appropriate for older readers.
Right.
And actually, it's now coming out in an expanded second edition because Donald Trump almost literally every day reveals the presence of additional fault lines. And so we added two new chapters, one of them on the president's pardoning power, the other on his power to hire and fire executive branch officials, and we also updated quite a bit of the data. We also do a blog once a month because the book is kind of an odd mixture of current events plus a fairly detailed overview of 1787 and how it is that the decisions were made in 1787 that really do explain a great deal today.
absolutely right. And I love the way in your book you go back and forth. You know, you start with some of the challenges we're facing today or have faced recently, and then you go into explaining, well, back when the Constitution was written, here's what they were thinking. And then you bring it back to, okay, now knowing all that, how do we apply this to our challenges today? And it's such a great way of making this history come alive and making us, helping us see how the Constitution is not some ancient document on parchment gathering dust, but it's actually a living, breathing document that so much guides our country, and yet it doesn't answer every question because, well, for many reasons, they couldn't agree themselves on a lot of things when they were first putting the Constitution together. So let's go back to some of the history, because I love the way you tell the story of the birth of the Constitution. And most people think that the Constitution began when the United States began. But that's not so, that we actually, when we won the American Revolution and threw off the yoke of British imperialism, the 13 states were actually saw themselves as very autonomous. The so-called central government was extremely weak, and we were governed by the Articles of Confederation. And the states kept running into problems that were kind of hard to solve, and there was no real strong central government that could even deal with it. And therefore, the Constitutional Convention was called, and that's when they got together and actually wrote the Constitution. Could you tell our listeners a little bit more about the origin story of the Constitution?
Well, I think you've done a superb job. That the basic origin story is that many, many people agreed with Alexander Hamilton and others that the system created by the Articles was, and this is their word, imbecilic, that it really represented a clear and present danger to the survival of the new country, that in the Federalist, or Federalist Papers, their modern name, the argument was that if we didn't ratify the new Constitution, the United States would disintegrate into two or three ultimately warring countries along the Atlantic coast.
We give several examples of what the problems were in the, at the time. In particular, one evidence of the lack of power of a central government then was that it couldn't tax the citizenry. And so the soldiers who had gone off and fought and won the American Revolution hadn't been paid. Congress tried to requisition $3.8 million at the time, worth about $100 million today, to pay off various war debts, including the soldiers. The states had no obligation, and no individual had any need to send any money to this so-called federal government, or really to the Confederation. They came up with $663. So the soldiers actually began to attack the people who went to what was then the capital because they wanted their money. So Confederation was really the right term at the time. It was like an agreement among those states along the eastern seaboard, but they had hardly any political or financial relationship with each other.
Right. There was no genuine taxing power. There was no genuine national armed force. States were, in fact, imposing tariffs against one another. So think of today's tariff war with China, but instead think of New Jersey and New York, at which were treating each other basically as foreign countries. And that was the reality of 1787. And one of the things we do not do, and I think it's an important part of our book, which is in many ways very, very critical of the Constitution, but one of the things we don't do is engage in founder bashing, because they were facing very, very real political problems that threatened the future of the country in 1787, and they did the best they thought they could. our criticism is a mixture, well, our criticism is really directed at us today who treat the 1787 Constitution basically as a sacred document that shouldn't really be examined with anything close to the same rigor that the framers examined the Articles of Confederation and that they expected would be the case with regard to the Constitution. They didn't think it would last forever, but to a remarkable and, we think, unfortunate degree, many of the most fundamental decisions made in 1787 have lasted in pristine form now 225 years later.
But getting back to your question about the origins, what happened was that Congress, realizing that the Articles could not sustain a country, one country, called for a convention in Philadelphia. It took a month for everybody to show up past the time. It was raining, the weather was bad, they had to get their crops in, that sort of thing.
Rhode Island didn't send anybody because they correctly feared that the convention would turn into what we today might call a runaway convention. Rhode Island mistakenly believed that they could rely on Article 13 of the Articles, which gave each state a veto power over any amendments. It turns out they got it disastrously wrong from their perspective, because Article 7 of the new Constitution said all it would take would be 9 states, and it would be conventions of 9 states, not the legislatures, even, of 9 states.
In any case, that was a jumping-off point for the creation of a new government.
Right, exactly. And we needed to have that stronger government. But, you know, it's amazing. They say you should never watch closely laws and sausages being made because it's so damn messy. But, and in fact, the attendees at that constitutional convention in 1787 were so concerned about how their deliberations might be met that they required kind of an oath of silence, and they even like burned the notes afterwards so people wouldn't know exactly who said what. And in general, I believe in sunshine and transparency and knowing what our elected officials and representatives are doing, but I think the fact that they had that privacy enabled them to work out some really tough issues and make some compromises to get to an agreement that has really worked pretty well. And when they came up with this Constitution, it was very revolutionary at the time. And the whole thing, the one that strikes me is that for the known history, the emperor or king would be the one who had the power to go to war. But when the Constitutional Convention was convened, the framers said, well, we're going to actually reserve the right to declare war to Congress only, not the president at all. Now, that's one of the aspects of the Constitution that hardly anybody knows, and it's actually been, I think, widely ignored by presidents over the past 70 years, including 7 wars that we're currently in at a cost of $6 trillion, not one of which has been approved by Congress. But tell us a little bit about how you see the Constitution that emerged from this convention in 1787. How new and revolutionary was it?
Well, I think what was revolutionary was the idea that you could have what they called a Republican form of government, but it was government traceable in at least some ways to what the Declaration of Independence called the consent of the governed, that you could have it over a very large area, at that point going from what is today Maine down to the southern border of Georgia and over to the east coast of the Mississippi River. Most people at the time really thought that was way too big. And so that was one of the most audacious features. And they gave a tremendous amount of power to the new government. But, you know, both of those were genuinely new. And the paradox with being a, you know, radically different constitution, which it was, is that they really had very little experience to draw on. They were making it up as they went along. And today, 230 years later, and this is not meant as a knock on the framers, we know a lot more than they did about the strengths and weaknesses of the Constitution. So this is why I come back to what the main theme of the book is, which is to ask whether the decisions they made 230 years ago necessarily serve us well today. But there's no doubt that it was regarded as a basically revolutionary document.
And certainly the role of the people was revolutionary as well. It was not clear who the people were other than pretty much white guys of property. But there was that belief, at least in part, that the people could have a role in governing themselves.
Right, exactly. And I remember I visited Constitution Hall in Philadelphia once, and I went there and I was just kind of, first of all, in awe of what these guys did in putting together the Constitution. And, you know, first of all, declaring war against the biggest empire in the history of the world and winning, and then putting together this amazing document, the Constitution. But I was heartbroken that the ones who believed that truly all men were created equal and were against slavery were outvoted. And, you know, I come from Massachusetts. I've been to the home of John and Abigail Adams and totally love them and what they did and the role they played in the founding of the country and the high integrity they brought to all that they did. But I thought, well, you know, how heartbreaking that they lost the fight to say, yeah, there's our chance to free the slaves. But what hit me as I was standing in the room where this discussion had happened was that the people who believed in the abolition of slavery just did not have the right vote, you know, enough votes to win. And that the only way that they were going to get this government formed was to allow the slavery to continue, and that their belief was that in time that the process of being able to amend the Constitution would lead to the abolition of slavery. Now, it took a lot longer probably than John Adams and his colleagues thought, but they were actually right. If they had stuck too hard to their guns around forcing for abolition, then we wouldn't have really had the United States. We would have had the fractured 13 states which would consider themselves independent nations with their, as you were talking about, putting their own tariffs on the sale of goods to the other states. And so it was kind of a tough bargain, but one that was essential for the birth of the nation. I know, what do you think about that?
Well, I think, again, you're right, but it underscores the real issue of compromise. How much are you willing to give away in order to get something you think important? So there were two major compromises in Philadelphia. One is often taught as the capital G, capital C, Great Compromise, the one that gives each state two votes in the Senate. James Madison, in fact, thought it was terrible. He described it as a lesser evil. What it was lesser than was not having a constitution at all, but it was evil, because there is no justification, really, for giving Delaware and Virginia the same voting power in the Senate. Many people made the same calculation with slavery, which was equally indefensible, but you had to swallow hard and collaborate with slave owners if you wanted a constitution. So the crucial question is, to what degree should we feel bound by deals that were made simply because you were looking down the barrel of a gun. And people said, look, give us what we want or we're going to walk out. Nobody today, or nobody, very few people in the 1860s said, we really do have to honor promises made to slave owners. Whatever you think of slavery, we're a slave republic. It took 750,000 deaths to end slavery. It was not the Constitution working itself pure. It was Americans killing one another. And so the question is, to what extent should we in 2019 feel bound to some very problematic decisions made in 1787, even if one can defend them in terms of the political realities one was facing in 1787? But we really don't have to collaborate with racists today. If we do, it's our decision. It's not because the Constitution requires it or keeping the country together requires the kinds of compromises that we are still being asked to make.
Yeah, and just to follow up on that point, you know, you're talking about the agreement that they came to, if I'm understanding correctly, the Great Compromise was when they said, well, we'll have two houses in Congress. One will be the Senate, one will be the House. And in the House, we'll have congressional districts, each of equal size. So it's kind of a one-person, one-vote representation in the House of Representatives. And then we'll have the second body of Congress, which is the U.S. Senate, where every state gets two votes. So that way, even the small states feel like, oh, we're going to have, you know, we'll have equal power with the big states. And, of course, now here we are all these years later. When you say two votes for a small state are equal to the two votes of a big state, you're now talking about a small state like Vermont might have, say, 620,000 mm-hmm. people total. They have as much power in the Senate as the state of California, which has whatever it is, 37 million people.
Or it's getting up to 40 million.
Yeah, pushing 40 million. So, you know, why should the small, and they're often the small rural states, actually in that sense Vermont's a bad example, but they, some of the other small states like Wyoming, North Dakota, South Dakota, some of the smaller states tend to be more rural and more conservative, and therefore, it gives a very distorted sense of power to the smaller states than the bigger states like California and New York, that it's really kind of at this point not only imbalanced, that it's grossly unfair. Is that part of what you're talking about?
Sure. I mean, Vermont is a great example. Given my own political preferences, I much prefer Senator Sanders and Senator Leahy to our two Texas senators, Ted Cruz and John Cornyn, mm-hmm. but Vermont is a strikingly rural state. As a matter of fact, it wasn't until he chose to run for president that Bernie Sanders started displaying any interest at all in gun control, because mm-hmm. Vermont, as you would expect, is basically a pro-gun state. Bernie Sanders votes for subsidies for the dairy industry, and I'm not necessarily criticizing him for doing so, but we should not confuse ourselves in believing that Bernie Sanders had any real policies about urban America until he decided to run for president. And that is one of the really warped features of the Senate.
And in fact, Vermont is also a good example because it shows a way that we bring the relevance of the imbalance in the Senate to today, the story that we tell that opens the chapter about the Senate called Big States, Little Say has, in fact, to do with Vermont, where Senator Leahy, who was chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, was able to structure the funds, the distribution of funds following 9/11, so that every state would receive 0.75% of the monies that were allocated. That meant
at least.
Yeah, at least. Yeah, well, there was a minimum. Sorry, yeah. And that meant that small states per capita got much more money per capita than the large states did. And the small states, frankly, were not at risk in the future to terrorism as the large states were. Wyoming, which got $61 per person, was just not likely to get attacked nearly so much as, say, California with a long Pacific coastline, which got only $14 per person. And that's because of the sway, or largely because of the sway, that Senator Leahy from Vermont and coalitions with other small state senators were able to cobble together to distribute the funds in that way.
I mean, I think that the importance of Cynthia's point and the graphic we have is that some of the time it's absolutely crucial whether a senator is Republican or Democratic. Other times, frankly, it's not all that important. If you want to understand American agricultural policy, which has all sorts of problems, it really doesn't matter whether some of the upper Midwest states are represented by Democrats or Republicans, or whether Vermont is represented by a Democrat or Republican, because all of the senators, regardless of their party, are going to fight like mad for subsidies for corn growers in the upper Midwest or for the dairy industry in Vermont. And so Pat Leahy was being a good representative of his very few constituents in getting sums of money for Vermont that under no rational theory they really deserved.
Right, that's interesting. And then there's another implication of this thing where each state gets the two senators, no matter how big or small they are. You talk in your book about the efforts to try and get background checks and some kind of gun safety measures, and that we've got over 90% of the citizens in the U.S. support background checks, and in spite of that, that there's enough power in the smaller states in the Senate, particularly, you know, there a lot of them tend to be rural, that they can successfully block any legislation around gun safety, even though vast majorities of the American citizens want them. So it's like you're saying,
this is also a function, frankly, of the fact that the Republican Party has become the loyal servant of the NRA.
Right. So well, that too. Well, let's not disregard the power of the gun industry and its the National Rifle Association as their lobbying arm, of course. But, you know, their job gets easier to influence through their lobbying by the fact that they don't have to buy off everybody. They, you know, just get some of these smaller states to go with them and they win.
But that's absolutely right. It is cheaper to influence elections in small states than in large states. If you're running for office in Texas or California, you're really going to have to amass literally millions of dollars. This gives too much power, to be sure, to some very, very wealthy donors, but it tends at least a bit to lessen the power of single-issue groups or, you know, particular ideological zealots. If, on the other hand, you're running in the Dakotas or in Vermont, Idaho, etc., then it doesn't take that much to blanket the media markets and to discourage insurgents from running for office. This is another consequence, particularly of the Senate.
Yeah, true enough. Now, to introduce this show, I talked about the current situation where our current president is really grabbing for power and in every direction one can imagine, and people believing that the Constitution's going to protect us from this arrogation of power to one guy. I want to ask your sense, since you're deep into the Constitution and what it does and doesn't do, how much can we rely on the Constitution to defend us against this major power grab that's going on right now?
Well, the Constitution isn't protecting us now. The Constitution really is enabling it, frankly. There's nothing in the... We talk, and many people refer to the checks and balances in the Constitution, and that certainly is a possibility. And at times, Congress and the executive have acted that way. There are structures that can promote checks and balances. However, there's nothing that prevents the president from doing what he's been doing recently. He and Senator McConnell, Mitch McConnell, are simply taking full advantage of what the Constitution allows them to do. If at least one house, in this case it's the Senate, doesn't step up and act on behalf of its constituents, then the president is not stopped from moving the fulcrum over.
Yeah, I think Cynthia is right. But I would also emphasize the paradox at the heart of the notion of checks and balances, that we might have what I think is a completely fictitious notion that there's a kind of an automatic process by which everything will balance out. But in fact, if you read James Madison, particularly in Federalist 51, what he really argued is that ambition would counter ambition, and that the zeal of members of Congress to protect their own power would lead them to oppose presidential overreaching, and so on and so forth. But that doesn't turn out to be the case. I mean, it is very obviously the case that the Republican Senate is nothing more than the enabler of whatever Donald Trump wants to do. It's also the case that if you're going to talk about ambition countering ambition, then it turns into an endless tennis match, that where victory will go to the person who can hold out longest. And Donald Trump clearly is not willing to be a good sport and to say, well, I guess I'm going to lose this one. He'll keep fighting and fighting and fighting. And Congress is not willing to stand up to him in any serious way. And although I really do, quite frankly, despise Donald Trump, I do think that his presidency reveals some real fault lines in the Constitution, that for the Constitution to work, it requires good character, which the president certainly doesn't have. And you mentioned before the importance of compromise in 1787. It requires a willingness to compromise. Two political scientists at Harvard, in a book they called How Democracies Die, talked about the importance of what they called forbearance. You don't push every advantage you might have. But Trump is going to push every advantage he's got. And frankly, there is no good reason to believe that either Congress or the judiciary is going to stand up to him as much as they should. It will ultimately be up to us to vote him out of office. Impeachment clearly doesn't work. So it really is the next election that will fit the cliche, the most important election in our lifetime.
I think this comes from a couple of factors back in 1787. One was the framers assumed that the president would be a person, a man, of good standing, would be respectable and respectful. And they assumed also that the Electoral College would help assure that every president would be a person of good standing.
And then you're thinking of George Washington.
Exactly. At the same time, there were people at the time who believed that the president should have more power than the Constitution was giving him. So there were part of the debates and part of the compromises were how strong should the executive branch be? Well, it allows for a quite strong executive on the presumption that the president would be a fine, you know, member of the community.
The new edition of our book contains two brand new chapters as well as lots of new data. One of the new chapters concerns the president's pardoning power, because frankly, when we were writing the book in 2016, although we did take into account Trump's election, we did not talk about the pardoning power. But now, of course, everybody is familiar with the possibility not only that he might end up pardoning some of his close associates who were engaging in criminal enterprises, but that he might ultimately even pardon himself. So we talk about that. We also added a chapter on the president's power to hire and fire. And in fact, there was a big, big debate about this in 1789, 1790. The Constitution requires that the Senate confirm appointees, though as a matter of fact, one of the notable things that Donald Trump is doing is either not nominating people at all or naming acting secretaries of this, that, and the other who are not confirmed by the Senate, as well as creating this alternative government in the White House that includes people like his daughter and son-in-law. And very importantly, he can fire at will. And as I say, there was a genuine debate about this in 1789, 1790. And John Adams, I regret to say, broke a tie vote in the Senate. There was a 10-10 vote. He broke the tie in favor of the ability of the president to fire without getting any sort of acquiescence of Congress. So, you know, if it weren't for that vote in 1790, it's very possible that Congress or the Senate would have had to acquiesce in the firing of James Comey or the firing of Jeff Sessions, who turns out to be at least a minimal sort of hero in terms of having some respect for the notion of rule of law. And that didn't count for anything with Trump. So these are the issues we bring forward in the new edition because, frankly, Donald Trump presents new illustrations of the actuality of these fault lines almost literally every day.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that a little bit. First of all, I just want to acknowledge how sad I am that it was my hero, John Adams, who voted that way, that now leaves us stuck with the folks we've got under the Trump administration. But you raised the question about the degree to which the president has the power of pardon, and we're watching him give pardon to, like, Joe Arpaio at the sheriff, who's been such an abuser of immigrants and human rights, and it can go on and on. Who knows, you know, friend Jerry Epstein with the sexual predator, you know, gets convicted. Well, you know, Trump at any point can say, you're pardoned.
Any point will be after re-election or after he's lost.
What are the limits, if any, for a president to pardon any friends that he wants at any point in the legal process he wants, or even to pardon himself should he be convicted?
Well, the last one is an issue where lawyers will simply shout at one another about self-pardon. With regard to your first question, I think almost all lawyers would agree that the only check on a president is character and self-discipline.
Well, and the president cannot pardon someone who's convicted of impeachment.
Right. Impeachment is final with the Senate if they convict. But presidents have a huge discretion to pardon, and quite obviously we talk about this in the new edition of our book. And we talk about an essay that Alexander Hamilton wrote in The Federalist offering a very good defense of why you would want presidents to have this power, but he also offered in Federalist 68 a defense of the Electoral College as protecting us against demagogues with bad character. And there he turned out to be spectacularly wrong.
One of the things James Madison said was, the instances will be very rare in which an unworthy man will become president of the United States. So they weren't so worried about pardon power then. They thought it would be a gracious thing to be able to do. People do regret things that they've done. And I think they believe that also, if necessary, be a way to draw the country together, to get past, you know, serious squabbles. So there was a reason that they wanted the pardon power. I believe also did not Parliament or the King have pardon power?
Oh, sure. I mean, this is drawn from the power the King had to show mercy, or, as Cynthia mentions, to make very acute political decisions that sometimes you might want to execute somebody you viewed as a traitor. Other times you might pardon that person and basically welcome him back into the country. And the very, very first in our history by both Washington and Adams were of people who had been convicted of treason and sentenced to death. And both of them very wisely said that it would be stupid to create martyrs, far better to welcome them back. And they came back into the country, and now almost literally nobody except professional historians even knows their names.
Yeah, very interesting. Well, you mentioned in passing that the framers believed that the Electoral College would be kind of a check on making sure we had a man of integrity as president, and that was the whole idea, was that the Electoral College would know who the candidates would be, and they would not allow for any tyrant or evil person to get into the office of the presidency. But I think a lot of Americans didn't even know we had an Electoral College until 2016, when Hillary Clinton won the popular vote by over 3 million votes, and yet we ended up with Trump as president. Can you explain a little bit about, like, why did they do the Electoral College, and what do you think we should do about it now?
The second one is especially hard. There were lots of competing notions on how to elect the president, or how to choose a president, really. And the decision wasn't made until near the end of the Constitutional Convention that summer of 1787, in part because they had to decide first what the president could and couldn't do, what that person's powers were going to be. One proposal was that Congress would choose the president, and that was, again, related to checks and balances. To whom was the president going to be beholden, and in what ways? There was also a proposal for direct election of the president, but nobody actually took that very seriously. So the idea for an Electoral College came about in part to address those issues, and in part because they were aware the country was then very rural, and there, you know, we're so accustomed now to fast and accessible media, it's hard to imagine that there really was not any national means for sharing news. So somebody who lived in, say, South Carolina might not have any idea of the name or circumstances or policies, positions of someone who was running for president or vying for the presidency in, say, New Jersey. So one way to address this problem was to have the people vote for not exactly the president, but to vote for people who would then meet and decide who the president was going to be.
Right. Local notables who were more likely to be plugged into national networks. And as I said a while ago, we're not really critical of that decision in 1787. You know, we kind of wish another decision had been made, but in 1787 it made sense There's also one other factor that we mention in the book, which is slavery, because it turns out that the Electoral College, as initially conceived and operating, gave a big advantage to slave states because they got extra representation for the number of slaves they had. This is a so-called three-fifths rule. But it's important to note that anti-slavery people didn't want slaves to be counted at all because obviously they didn't vote and their masters were so-called masters were not going to take their slaves' interests into account. Whereas if the Southerners or slave owners had had their way, they would have been happy if slaves counted as five people so long as they didn't vote. So the so-called three-fifths compromise gave slave states, Virginia being the most prominent example, extra voting power, whereas if we had moved immediately to a single national vote, then that would have been detrimental to the interests of the slave states. And they were well aware of this. This is part and parcel of the accommodation with slavery that was arguably necessary to get a constitution in the first place, so that seven of our first nine presidents were slave owners. They tended to appoint pro-slavery justices to the U.S. Supreme Court, and you know, this is part of the logic of the 1787 Constitution.
Right, and so in 2016, when so many people woke up to the fact that we actually do have an electoral college that's not just a defunct thing on paper, but it actually has power, that they said, you know, why should we now, in this day and age, be stuck with an agreement that was meant to placate slave owners, and why don't we just abolish the Electoral College? But, of course, to do that, we'd have to get a constitutional amendment and change the Constitution. So I've been excited to see some of the states taking action and saying, well, we're passing legislation in our state that says whatever the vote is in our state for president, that is whoever the electors are in the Electoral College representing our states are going to have to vote the way that the citizens in our state have voted. And that
or the way the citizens nationally
yes,
have voted.
Or whoever wins the national popular vote is going to get our Electoral College vote from our state. How far has that gone? Like, how many states are doing that now, and do you think that's a good idea?
We have the number in the new edition, but frankly, that was the number when the book went to press, and there are states that are considering this, but the fact is the number remains far short of the states with 270 electoral votes, and I don't think there is any possibility that sufficient states will pass it by next year. Secondly, I have very, very deep concerns about it because, frankly, it focuses only on the problems with 2016 or 2000, because, you know, don't forget that George Bush also came in second in the national popular vote, but got to the White House thanks to the Supreme Court and the Electoral College. But I'm also at least as concerned with the elections of 1968 and 1992, where Richard Nixon and Bill Clinton got to the White House with 43% of the vote. My own view is that anybody who becomes president of the United States should be able to make a genuinely plausible argument that he or she is the majority's choice. We could have a runoff system. We could have the so-called alternative transferable ballot that's been now adopted in Maine for its congressional contests. But this new system would not protect us against presidents who have not demonstrated even close to majority support. And as I say, that concerns me at least as much as 2000 and 2016. The Electoral College overall is a dreadful way to elect a president, and this tweak might make it marginally better, but would still leave us with some major, major problems.
Just in response to your question, though, at least as of a couple of months ago, 14 states with a total of 189 electoral votes had signed on to the National Popular Vote Plan.
14 states.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we're a long way away. Well,
right.
Although I think California is one of them. That's a lot of votes there.
Yeah. There is a question whether or not they would actually abide by it. You know, who knows how many states agreed to sign on just because seems like, you know, an idea people would like because there is such popular sentiment against the Electoral College, but actually if they got close to the number of states needed for 270 electoral votes, it would be hard to imagine that California's Electoral College would actually vote for a Republican winner of a national popular presidential election.
Or, you know, maybe you could imagine California electors voting for a Republican winner if the Republican genuinely got a majority of the vote.
Mm.
But I think it's much, much harder to imagine electors in California voting for the Republican, even, you know, if we're talking, say, about a 1968 or a 1992 situation. 1968, there's no doubt that Richard Nixon came in first, but there's also no doubt that he had only 43% of the vote. So why should California electors necessarily feel bound to vote for Richard Nixon, or electors in 1992 feel bound to vote for Bill Clinton merely because they crossed the finish line first?
Yeah, it's a thorny question, all right. And speaking of California and the Constitution, I noticed, I think it was last week, the governor of California signed into law a requirement that any primary candidate for president is required to release 5 years of taxes to be put on the ballot, which, of course, is a shot for Trump to force him to release his taxes, if he wants to have any chance of votes in California. But some people say that that's constitutional, anti-constitutional, because the Constitution does not put that as a requirement for someone being president, but at the same time, the states are given the power around voting. So what do you see? Is that law now constitutional or unconstitutional?
I really don't have anything to add to what you just said. The one thing we can be absolutely certain of is that Donald Trump will litigate it. And you can be absolutely certain that he will find a lawyer who will quote part of what you just said and say that the Constitution doesn't require this and that it is illegal for states to add to a requirement. What California will do is find lawyers who will argue altogether correctly that we don't have national elections in this country. Every election is run by the states. And who knows whether or not states can add this sort of requirement as a price for being on the ballot. We know that states can't say you have to be 40 instead of 35. That seems to be crystal clear. But I don't think it's crystal clear at all whether states can say if you want to be on the ballot, you have to release your tax returns.
You pointed out at the beginning of the program that Sandy is a constitutional scholar, which is definitely true. I often ask him questions of the kind that you just asked, or we talked earlier about the pardon. Can the president pardon himself? And as you know, as he said just a little while ago, lawyers will shout at each other about that. He points out to me, not infrequently, that many of these questions don't actually have answers yet until someone contests them. And some court, ultimately the Supreme Court presumably, will come up with an answer. Then we'll know.
Right, which is a scary thought, as the Republicans have been packing the courts with their conservative extreme right. judges. But very interesting. Well, we just have 1 minute to go, and I want to ask you before we sign off here about Heidi Schreck, who is the playwright of my new favorite play on Broadway called What the Constitution Means to Me. I saw it last month on Broadway and was really struck with it. It was way more interesting and emotionally powerful than I expected. And I know the two of you have been in contact with her. Can you say a little bit what you think of that play and about your conversations with her about the wonderfulness and some of the concerns about the Constitution?
Yes, well, we agree with you about the play. We've now seen it several times and think it's just a wonderful evocation of, you know, from her personal family perspective, of the ways that the Constitution has badly, you know, affected particularly women in her family, and as the play points out, also gay people as well. Heidi came to a teacher workshop that Sandy and I gave in New York when the first edition of the book came out, and it was during the time that she was writing the play. The book evidently had a great effect on her. In fact, she wrote an endorsement, a blurb for the cover of the book, in which she said, "This provocative and fascinating book brought the Constitution to life for me, made me question my deepest assumptions about our country. The questions it raises became an essential part of the debate in my play, What the Constitution Means to Me, and I wish every student in America would read it." Well, we certainly can't disagree with her, and we are honored to know that, as you saw, the end of the play, which involves a debate with a high school student about whether or not the Constitution, she says abolish, we would prefer something like replaced. We're delighted to know that it had such a big effect on her. In fact, in May, we were invited to do a talk back after the performance at the Helen Hayes Theater on Broadway, and again, we were honored to be a part of that process.
Wonderful. Well, I do hope every citizen reads it as well as every student. That's all the time we have. The book is Fault Lines in the Constitution. Cynthia and Sanford Levinson, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.